the parsha of the Balosecha reintroduces us to the menorah. This is the third time in the Chumash we find the menorah discussed. Originally we have it in Parshas Tetzaveh, and then in Chumash Vayikra we have it at the end of Parshas Emor, and the third and final time in the beginning of Balosecha. And interestingly, there's a certain question that troubles Meforshim. It's a question that it's very easy to gloss over and miss, but as soon as it's pointed out, it becomes rather difficult. The Pasuk reads in Perek Ches, Pasuk Beis, Daber el Aaron, v'amarta elav, Moshe is told to speak to Aaron and say to him, Ba'alosecha es aneros, when you kindle the lights of the menorah, el mul panei menorah ya'iru shivas haneros. The seven lights, they will face what is called Pinei HaMenorah. Now the question is, what is Pinei HaMenorah? Literally, the face of the menorah, what does that mean? Rashi comments and says, El Mul Pinei HaMenorah means El Mul Ner HaEmtzai. The reference is to the middle light. Why is it called Pinei HaMenorah, the face of the menorah? She'eno Bikinim. Because it's actually the only light in the menorah that isn't a branch. Elabagusha the menorah. It's actually the menorah itself, so to speak. It doesn't branch out from the menorah. It just kind of keeps on going until it's a light. So that is the menorah, and that's the Pnei HaMenorah. And so, Rashi has explained that the term Pnei HaMenorah refers to the middle light, the Ner HaEmtzai. The problem is, if we read the Pasuk now, dare I say it, in light of Rashi's comment, then if the Pnei HaMenorah is the middle light, how can the Pasuk say, El Mul Pnei HaMenorah Ya'iru Shivas Haneros? There will be seven lights facing the middle. That's not so. There are six lights facing the middle, and then together there are seven. But you do not have seven lights facing the menorah. What are we to make of the words, El Mul Pnei HaMenorah Ya'iru Shivas Haneros? So that's a question for the medakdikim, people who like to keep an eye on the numbers here. The seven lights lit, but six of the seven are facing the middle. And Meforshi Rashi explain each one in their own way, but I would like to use this as a launch for the words of the Sforno, because as we will see, he deals with this question overtly, and moreover, the way he deals with it is actually by reading the Pasuk somewhat differently. I mean, how differently can one read it? Well, we'll see. Because the way we have read it, once again, if we begin from Ba'alosecha es aneros, we pause there. That's a natural pause for us. Ba'alosecha es aneros, when you kindle the lights, then El Mul Pnei HaMenorah Ya'iru Shivas Haneros. The seven lights will face the middle, which of course for us is a problem. Why do we stop after the words Ba'alosecha es aneros? We are following the marker on top of the words Neros, so the two dots which are called a Zokef, and they indicate a pause. So if they indicate a pause, so we pause, and then we continue the rest of the Pasuk. However, the Sforno, and although it's a larger discussion, he does not seem to be as guided, or as locked into the signals from the Tamei HaMikra, and the essential is that he reads the first two phrases together. He reads, Ba'alosecha es haneros el mul pnei haMenorah, and then he pauses. And the final words, Ya'iru shivas haneros, are a phrase in themselves. And what is the meaning, in his words, Ba'alosecha es haneros, when you kindle the lights, says Sforno, kishetadlik es sheish haneros, when you light the six lights, el mul pnei haMenorah, shehu kakane haEmtzai, which is the middle branch. So in his words, Ba'alosecha es haneros el mul pnei haMenorah, the Torah didn't specify how many neros are meant to face. Obviously six, says the Sforno. When you light those six lights facing the middle, then the result will be Ya'iru Shivas Haneros, meaning you will then have the result which is called the seven lights will be lit. Kol Hashiva Ya'iru, they will light, V'yashpiyu Or Elyon LeYisrael, and they will bestow supernal light for the Jewish people. According to the Sforno, Ya'iru Shivas Haneros is not a physical description, it's a spiritual result called Ya'iru Shivas Haneros. The goal of the menorah is not just to provide physical illumination, it's in order to bring down a higher light. Is there a way to do that? Yes, be sure that the six are facing inwards. And what is the meaning of the inwards? Because, says the Sforno, there are two types of people in the Jewish people. There are those who branch out to the right, and there are those who branch out to the left, what he calls Maiminim and Masmi'ilim. And what defines these two groups of people? Says Sforno, you have the Maiminim, those to the right, Ha'oskim Bechaye Olam. Their occupation, what they spend their day in, is spiritual matters. That's one branch, that's one direction to branch out in. Then you have the Masmi'ilim, those who branch out in the other direction. Ha'uskim b'chayei sha'a. They're working, they're involved in parnasa, matters of this world. And what's the point? Ha'ozrim le'maiminim. In the end of the day, they support the maiminim. For Amram, he quotes an interesting statement from the Gemara in Chulin. Ilmale alya lomitkaime itkalya. Which is Aramaic, as it sounds. And what it means is, don't belittle the leaves of the vine. If it wasn't for the leaves, you wouldn't have the grapes. And therefore, you have these two groups of people. And what's the point? The point is both groups, in order to be successful in what they're doing, need to face towards the middle. The middle is not a group. The middle is, what is it all for? Tiyeh la'afik ratzon ha'kel yisbarach. It's in order to do Hashem's will. Ba'ofan shiusag mechuvano ben kulam, that between all of these groups working together, and moreover appreciating each other, that's called a menorah. If the different groups amongst the Am Yisrael appreciate what they're doing, but also they appreciate that there's something higher than what they're doing, and all of them are facing towards that way, that's called facing the middle branch, and that's what will lead to Ya'iru Shivas Haneros. And moreover, says the Sforno, this is the meaning of the second Pasuk as well. That is to say, Pasuk Dalet for us, which describes the menorah. V'ze ma'aseh ha-menorah miksha zahav. And again, we might read the Pasuk as, this is how the menorah should be made, from one block of gold. But the Sforno says, v'ze isn't facing forwards, it's facing backwards. As if to say, v'ze, it's for this, as if to say, it is for this reason that the menorah is made from one block of gold. Because the Jewish people are all made from one block of gold, even though some of them branch out this way, and some of them branch out the other way. And this is the message that comes out from the menorah in the beginning of Baha'losecha. And so as we see, the Sforno has dealt, of course, along the way with the pshat issue. Indeed, Ya'iru Shivas Haneros is the result, but it's a higher form of light. And moreover, as Rav Koopman points out in his Perush to the Sforno, these words can perhaps answer to us a very basic question. Namely, what has the Torah told us in the beginning of Baha'losecha about the menorah that it hadn't already told us the first two times? The messages themselves, as if to say the practicalities that they should face towards the middle, have already been mentioned in Parshas Emor. That it should be made from one block of gold has already been mentioned in Parshas Tetzaveh. So it just seems to be chazorah, repetition, which of course cannot be. But what is mischadish here? So it says Rav Koopman, according to the Sforno, the Torah at this stage in Baha'losecha is no longer describing the practicalities of the menorah, but it's describing the goal of the menorah. It's describing the essence of what the lighting of the menorah is all about. The first two times is how to do it. The third time is what it's all about and what you hope to achieve thereby, and what is the message for the way the Jewish people go about their lives, each one in whatever branch they are. And one may suggest further, for if we may ask, which I think is a good question, what is this third iteration or this third discussion of the menorah doing here in Parshas Baalotzecha? It seems to come out of the blue. Well, Rashi, of course, has answered the question in his way, because according to Rashi, this is famously Aaron's compensation. He wasn't involved in the Chanukah Samishkan, which is described at length in Parshas Noso. It's the second half of Parshas Noso. Chol Shadato, he wasn't involved. Hashem said, but yours is greater than theirs. You will be lighting the menorah. And therefore, in a sense, what Rashi's done, aside from anything else, is explained what the Torah is doing, discussing the menorah again. And here, in Baalotzecha, it's more connected to the end of Noso, according to Rashi. But for the Sforno, we may suggest that actually these three or four psukim that relate to the menorah are connected to what follows, not what came before. Because what does follow? The separation of the Levim to become sanctified for the Mikdash, and within them the Kohanim, because of what happened with the Egel, etc. and so forth. And that is described with a good couple of dozen psukim. And what do we see here? We see here the formal separation to a degree of a certain group amongst the Bnei Yisrael. In terms of our discussion, Shevet Levi are branching out to the right, in the sense that they have involvements that other people don't have. This is the point that it's important to emphasize, that when Levi branches out to the right, they're not moving away, but rather, as much as different groups will branch in different ways, it's all the more critical for them to face towards the middle, and thus it is preempted with this message about the menorah. So that's a very interesting approach of the Sforno to the beginning of Baalotzecha, to the parsha of the menorah discussed for the third time. Now, if we move to the beginning of Perek Tes, and Perek Tes is famous, there's many, many different topics discussed in Parshas Baalotzecha. And Perek Tes is the parsha of Pesach Sheni. That's what makes it famous. It starts with Pesach Rishon, but then there were certain people that they couldn't do Pesach Rishon, and they came and complained, which is itself a chiddush. And moreover, they were responded to with Pesach Sheni, which is even a further chiddush. But I would like this evening, as much as Pesach Rishon begets Pesach Sheni, actually to focus on the Pesach Rishon itself. And let's have a look at how the Perek begins. Perek Tes, Pasuk Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'midbar Sinai b'shana hashenis letesam eretz Mitzrayim b'chodesh harishon lemor. Hashem speaks to Moshe, it's the second year, the first month. That is to say, Nisan, Pesach time. And the message is, v'yasu b'nei Yisrael esah posach b'moado. They should perform and fulfill the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. Okay, but coming back to Pasuk Aleph, which gives us the timing here, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Rashi has an interesting comment. Parsha Sheberosh HaSefer, if you take a look, says Rashi, you'll note, I mean, we were in Perek Tes. We've gone 8 chapters already into Bamidbar. If you look at these episode or item that opens the Sefer, you'll note Lo Nemra Ad Iyar. It wasn't said until a month later, as the pasuk itself says. It's a Bechecha Bechodesh Hasheini, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, the counting, that first counting that opens the Sefer. So that's interesting. Chapter 1 starts describes something that happened a month later than sounds a lot like Lamadato, we learn from here, She'en Seder Mukdama Mu'ukha B'Torah, that the chronological sequence of events is not always preserved in the Torah. There are other things the Torah wishes to communicate. It's not always the highest priority to have the chronological sequence. V'lama l'pasach bazu, and nu, says Rashi, why Taka did it not open with this? I mean, you could say Mukdama Mu'ukha B'Torah, but it's fair to ask, well, why not? Why not open with this? Mipneshu gnusan shel Yisrael. Because this section of Bamidbar reflects badly on Bnei Yisrael. How so? Because shekol arboim shana shehayu Yisrael Bamidbar lo hikrivu ela pesach ze bilvad. Because if you read between the lines, or you just think about it, Bnei Yisrael were in the Midbar for 40 years, and this was the only time they brought a Korban Pesach. So that's not so good. One for 40 is not so good. So that's called Gnusan Shel Yisrael. It's interesting because it's not announced by the Torah. I mean, the Torah talks about them doing the Pesach that year. It doesn't really talk about them not doing the Pesach in other years, but says Rashi, but that's a rather loud silence, and therefore it does come out, that message, and it reflects badly, and that's why the Chumash did not open with this. Now, what's very interesting to note, just in terms of Rashi's, I would say, methodology here, is Rashi's done something unusual. This is not the first time that Rashi has mentioned the idea of Ein Mukdam Umu'ucha Batorah. I mean, that's a concept that has accompanied Rashi throughout the Torah. The first time, I think, is even in Parshas Bereishis. However, and there's a number of times in between, however, it is the first time, as far as I know, where Rashi not only identifies and makes the comment that the order has not been preserved, but then proceeds to ask, why not? Which, of course, is a good shaila, but it is a shaila you could always ask. I mean, so that's really, it's the follow-up question. Number one, identify. Ein Mukdam Baruch HaTorah is in play here. Number two, and why was the order not preserved? Rashi never asks that question. Apparently, Rashi feels that's a good question, but it's no longer a pshat question. In other words, the pshat is to make Seder in the Psukim or to identify if they're out of chronological order. Once you've done that, your work is done. Why then could one ponder the Torah placed things not in chronological sequence? Ask someone else, or ask Rashi, when he's not writing Perush Rashi on the Torah. I'm sure I'll have a lot to say. But here, Rashi does take that further step and say, V'loma lo posach bazo, interestingly. We may ask, Manishtana ha time hazem, you call her other times? And I believe the answer is very simple. And that is because this instance is different, even in terms of the psukim. How so? Because in all of the other occasions where Rashi invokes the idea or brings in the idea of Ein Mukdam Umu'ucha Batorah, he detects that the psukim are out of order, or he concludes that they're out of order based on various reasons, whatever they may be. This instance, there's nothing to detect. If you can read Hebrew and you can count, you will know that these psukim are out of order, because the Torah itself timestamped them. The Torah said Beferush in chapter 1, verse 1, that this is Rosh Chodesh Iyar. And then it told us explicitly in chapter 9, verse 1, that this is in Nisan, which means this is an unusual case of Ein Mukdam Umu'ucha Batorah. The Torah has gone out of its way to let you know that the psukim are written out of order. There must be a message that the Torah wants me to get here. And this says, Rashi, I've got to respond. And I'm still responding to Pshuta Shemikra. Why does the Torah want me to know about this? What's the message here? The Torah wants me to, that it's Gnusan Shel Yisrael. And we proceed and ask, because it's important. One could ask almost naively, if indeed this whole Pesach situation, it's Gnusan Shel Yisrael, it reflects badly, so here's a suggestion. Don't talk about it at all. I mean, one never likes to say something that reflects badly about the Jewish people. If you've got something that reflects negatively on someone, to say, oh, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to start with that. But when I get to chapter 9 of what I'm talking about, I'll put it in there, and then somehow it will be buffered by other things. That's not acceptable. If it's negative, you can never talk about it. But of course, the answer is, well, when the Torah talks about it, it's because you have to talk about it, and we have to learn from it. It's not pleasant, but we have to learn from, we are the Jewish people, we have to learn from the Jewish people's mistakes. So you have to talk about it. At that point, the question only becomes, where do you talk about it? If it has to be said, when does it have to be said? And the answer, says Maharal, is not in the beginning. Because the way you open something sets the tone for that thing. If you open a chumash in a negative tone, you're setting a negative tone for that chumash. And that is incorrect, because even when the Jewish people make a mistake, and even when they fall from grace, and even when they slip up, that doesn't mean that they are a mistake. It doesn't mean that they are essentially negative in nature. They made a mistake. And makes all the difference in the world, therefore, if you open the sefer by talking about something negative, as if to say, it's the first thing that that we're going to talk about, because it's the first thing you really need to know. That's not true. The first thing you need to know about the Jewish people is not that they made a mistake. You need to talk about it at some stage, but that's not how you open. And interestingly, this idea of Maharal in the Gorari is echoed in his comments in the beginning of Chumash Devarim. As we know, Rashi tells us that the first pasuk of Chumash Devarim, which is essentially a list of places, Eila Hadvarim Asher Dibre Moshe, Be'eva HaYardein, Barava, Mosul, Ben Paran, Ben Tofel, the Chatzeros, Velavan, Beti Zahav. It's just a lot of places. It almost hasn't said anything yet. And along comes Rashi and says, no, actually, that first pasuk has said it all. All of the places enumerated in that opening pasuk are reference of places where the Jewish people did something wrong. Mulsuf, the Yamsuf, they complained. Dizahav, Egel Hazav. Hatzeros, Paran. Chetamaraglim, whatever it may be. And what is the point of the pasuk? It's really referring to all of these mistakes. But then the question is, well, why didn't you mention the mistake? Why are you mentioning the place? It says Rashi, Mishum Kvodom Shel Yisrael. Respect for the Jewish people. To express the dignity of the Jewish people. Moshe doesn't openly rebuke them like that. He doesn't say, you made the Eger, and you said them right. But these are have Chatzeros. That's a respectful way to do it. Well, as the Mizrahi asks, that doesn't seem to be the approach that Moshe takes, you know, a little bit down the line. If the approach will be, there's no need to openly mention these mistakes. It's enough to mention the place, the Hamavin Yavin. Firstly, that's often not true. The person that really needs to hear rebuke tends to do whatever they can to get out of it, which means it's hardly well advised to just be Yotzei Yehovah by mentioning the place. If I mention the place, I'm sure the Jewish people will be duly chastened. They will not be chastened. They won't do anything. Moreover, 20 psukim into Chumash Devarim, we don't seem to see this approach at all. Moshe begins a play-by-play rebuke of the Meraglim, and it just keeps going. For pasuk after pasuk, and then in Perek Tes, it gets going on the Egel, Hazav, I mean, you never hear the end of it. So the Mizrahi says, oh, we will decide what your policy is. Are you going to take the elegant approach, the oblique approach, the veiled reference approach, or are you going to take the pasuk by pasuk tale unspoken? Says Maharal, you've got to take the detailed approach, but that's not how you begin. Day one of rebuke is conveying one message, respect for the Jewish people. This we need to be more explicit? Yes, we'll do that tomorrow. But again, it's a question of how you set the tone. If you start by saying, and you sent the Meraglim, and you sent the Egel, that's a message to the Jewish people saying that you're hopeless. No, you're not hopeless. You're very worthy. And here's my mark of respect for you. Once that's established, then the rebuke will bear fruit. Otherwise, it will just stigmatize the Jewish people into failure. And that's a klal gadol for everything, really. The way you begin sets the tone. It once occurred to me to suggest al derech hadrash, it's not pshat, they say at the outset, there is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which states, Hevi makdim shlom kol adam. Hevi makdim shlom kol adam. And what does that mean? Well, the simple understanding is that you should always be the first one to say hello. Don't wait for the other one to say hello to you. I mean, there could be standoffs there. You know, the day can come to a standstill. Rather, you say hello first. It's a good way to be. Don't stand on ceremony and wait for the other person. Okay, very nice. And thus we find, even the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Nasi Yisrael, right? He's the Nasi. The Gemara says, no one ever said hello to him first. He always said hello first. Afilu Nachri Bashuk, even a non-Jew in the market, he's walking, it's always hello. He's the Nasi. Some people are a fraction of a Nasi, they don't say hello even if you say hello to them first. That's the pshat. But perhaps there's room to say, because aside from anything else, according to the pshat, when two people try and fulfill this Mishnah, one of them will necessarily fail. But these are good failures to have. But perhaps you may suggest, Hevimakde Mishlom Kol Adam means, whenever there's something that you need to say to someone, first be maktim shalom. First say hello. First say shalom. Shalom validates the person. Then you can tell them that they're check bounced or they're fired or whatever. But the shalom at the beginning, it sets a tone, just as Moshe Rabbeinu did. That's Kvodam Shal Yisrael. And we might add, the word hello is rapidly disappearing from the English language. As everyone gets busier and busier, they get straight to the point. But in a sense, they miss the point. The point is whoever you're addressing is a valid person. And then everybody needs to make up for it afterwards, validating everyone else. And they still forget to say hello. So this is the question of how to begin. And moreover, and just to complete this part, to see how Rashi is working, if we go back of Achar Hadvar Ma'ele, once we've seen this the discussion, if we go back to the opening of Bamidbar, which is the count, as we said, Rashi on Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, states it's about counting Bnei Yisrael. There's Rashi, Mitochi Basan Nefonov, Mona Osam Kol Shah. Hashem counts the Jewish people the whole time because he loves them so much. As if to say, if he knows how many there are, I mean, why would he have them counted? Because when you love something, you count it even though you know how much you have or how much there is. When they left Mitzrayim, he counted them. And when they fell at the Egel, he counted them. And here he is counting them again, says Rashi. Those are Rashi's words on Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Hashem counts the Bnei Yisrael because he loves them. Now the question is, Rashi has never really spoken about this before. And he himself is telling us this is not the first time the Jewish people have been counted. He's given us two prior occasions. But on those occasions, Rashi never really addressed the question as to why Hashem counts the Jewish people. Apparently, it's not a question for Rashi. But if it's not a question for Rashi in Chumash Shemos, how does it become a question for Rashi in Chumash Bamidbar? I mean, counting is counting. Why does Rashi not comment only here? Secondly, it's interesting again if we're medactic. Rashi's comments are on Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. The instruction to count the Jewish people doesn't come till Pasuk Beis, with the words Su'u Esrosh Kol Hadas Bnei Yisrael. Pasuk Aleph actually has no instruction; it's just setting time and place. So this is actually a very difficult situation. Why is Rashi commenting on the counting when the Torah hasn't even mentioned the counting? It's just Pasuk Aleph. They're in the desert. It's the second year. It's the second month or whatever. Rashi says, you know why Hashem counts them? Well, I haven't read that yet. I would have read that if Rashi hadn't stopped me in Pasuk Aleph. I'd be in Pasuk Beis already. So it's an interesting situation, because Rashi went three entire chumashim without talking about it, but when he comes to talk about it, he can't even wait till the Torah talks about it. Says the Bartanura, Rabbi Mavajami Bartanura, who's famous, of course, for his parish on the Mishnayos, but also has a short commentary or a series of short comments on Perush Rashi. Bartanura says a wonderful thing, and that is Rashi's comment is on Pasuk Aleph. Because, as we've mentioned, the Torah states explicitly that this happened in Iyar, in the second month, and it knows, and it wants us to know, that this is not the earliest event. Why was the earliest event not discussed first? Because it's Gnusan Shal Yisrael. Well, if the earlier chronological event was moved away from opening the Chumash, even though it's earliest, because it reflects badly, so by virtue of what will something else take its place? It's not the earliest event anymore, but rather it must be because it has what the earlier event didn't have. The earlier event reflected badly on the Jewish people. This later event, why does it open? Because it reflects positively on the Jewish people. says Rashi. How so? Because Hashem counts the Jewish people because he loves them so much. In other words, the very factor that disqualified the Korban Pesach from opening, even though it was earlier, is what qualifies the counting. So Rashi says, I've got to talk to you about it now. It's a pshat question now, because the Pasuk opened with a later event and told us so. And that's why Rashi's comment is on Pasuk Aleph, because he's commenting on the timing for Rosh Chodesh Iyar. He doesn't wait till Pasuk Beis. So these are, we see how the comments of Rashi are working together. Moreover, it's in conclusion for this aspect, I'd like to suggest that everything that we have said so far in the name of Rashi, from reading Rashi's words, is alluded to in Pasuk Aleph, in the Tame HaMikra. The Tame HaMikra, the cancellation or the trop, which accompanies the words, they're there and first and foremost practically to know how to sing the Pasuk and where to pause. But the Vilna Gaon famously states, and from his Beis HaMedrash it comes out, that the Tame HaMikra do more than just tell you how to sing. They give tam to the Mikra. They give insight. They are their own form of commentary. Very interesting. There's a number of examples from the Vilna Gaon, and inspired by that, perhaps especially when there's such a concentration of Tame HaMikra, one really heavy traffic, so to speak, it really stands out. If we have a look in Perek Tes Pasuk Aleph, Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe, those three words have the same ta'am underneath, that right angle underneath them, and that is called the Munach. All the Tame HaMikra have names. That's called the Munach. Okay. The next ta'am is on the word B'midbar Sinai. It looks like a magnifying glass on the word Sinai. Tes Aleph. Midbar Sinai, that cham is called Lisha Gedola. Okay. Next, on Bashana Hashenis, you have those two crescents facing each other, which are known as Kadma Va'azla. And the final distinctive Tame HaMikra here are under the words Me'eretz Mitzrayim, which is called Darga Tavir. That the zigzag and then the downward slope with a dot is called Darga Tavir. So to summarize the ta'amim as we have them, and it's a lot together, three munachs, Atlisha Gadola, Kadma Va'azla, and Darga Tavir. How does this help the Jewish people? Well, these names, of course, themselves have meaning. The word munach means to be set aside. Okay. Tlisha Gadola, what is a tlisha? The tlosh is to detach something, to uproot it. Tolish. Kadma ba'azla, the word kadma means early, and azla is to go, and kadma ba'azla therefore means going early. And finally, darga tavir, darga from the word darga, madrega, level, and tavir is Aramaic for shavur. The shin becomes a tuff from Hebrew to Aramaic. Tavir is shavur. Okay, putting all that together, we now see that these Tame HaMikra are actually describing the situation of the Jewish people. How so? We begin with three munachs. And what does that mean? That means that this is chronologically the earliest episode to happen. And it's been munach three times. It has been set aside three times. It should have opened Parshas Bamidbar, which it did not. It did not open the second Parsha either, Nasser. Neither did it open Parshas Ba'alosecha. It's tucked in somewhere in the middle of number three, which means it has been munach on three occasions. And that represents a tlisha gedola. That is a great detachment, meaning it has been detached from its natural place. For as the pasuk states, as the ta'amim state, kadma va'azla. Kadma va'azla, which as we said means going early. This happened earlier than the others. This is the kadma va'azla. This went first. So the question is, well, if it went first, then why is it munach three times? Why the tlisha gadola? The answer is darga tavir. The level was broken, as Rashi explains, because the level the Jewish people had on the first year where they brought the Korban Pesach was not upheld. They fell from that level. And therefore, because of darga tavir, we have the Munach three times. We have the Klisha Gedola, even though it's the Kadma Ba'azla. So this, I believe, or suggest, is the contribution of Tamei HaMikra. I must say, gratitude in part for this suggestion is due to a Baal Kore. I was once in a certain shul. I got Levi. I got Shani, being a Levi. And after the Aliyah, you move to the side. The Baal Kore in that shul had a habit of reading excruciatingly slowly. And there I was, trapped at the side of the bima. You can't go anywhere, and you can't really do anything except listen to the Baal Kore. Except it really brought home, because as he goes through with each munach, and you kind of felt really Jewish history dragging on more and more in real time, so that it really hit me that these Tamei HaMikra are saying what they're saying. So on the one hand, you know, thanks to him. Having said that, I never did go back to that shul again. But that is a possibility there. Now, now, so here we are, and there's so much to say really on this, on this Gnus Anshel Yisrael. There's a lot to discuss, because again, Rashi has told us that the Jewish people, they only kept the Korban Pesach one time. They should have really done the Korban Pesach more, but they didn't. But that's not so simple, that statement. It's because Rashi himself has told us that in principle there is no Korban Pesach outside of Eretz Yisrael. Rashi told us that in Parshas Bo, the Chumash Shemos, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Kaf Hei. And the Pasuk itself says, I mean, there's room to understand the Pasuk in a number of ways, but the Pasuk does say, V'haya ki tavo el ha'aretz. It presents Korban Pesach ki tavo el ha'aretz. We know what that expression means. Asher yitein Hashem lachem ushmatem es avoda hazos. Korban Pesach, Zevach Pesach. And therefore the Mizrahi asks a simple question. How can Rashi here tell us that it reflects badly on the Jewish people that they didn't really keep any other Korban Pesachs when they were in the Midbar? This one was a Chiddush. They're not meant to keep the Korban Pesach beyond this point, according to Rashi in Parshas Bo, that it only applies in Eretz Yisrael. And the Mizrahi's first suggestion is that perhaps this comment of Rashi in Baal Osecha, in our Parsha, it reflects the other opinion amongst Chazal, namely that in principle, Korban Pesach can be brought anywhere. Although it says Kisavo ala Aretz, that's more descriptive. I mean, they were meant to be in Eretz Yisrael very quickly after leaving Mitzrayim, so it's descriptive, but it's not mandating that it's tied to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and Rashi reflects this, and this, in a sense, is consistent with the Mizrahi's approach. It's a major statement about Pirush Rashi. Namely, Mizrahi contends one does not necessarily need to expect that every comment of Rashi everywhere in Chumash will fit in with every other comment of Rashi. As if to say, Rashi's goal is itemized, pasuk by pasuk. He needs to give you the simplest explanation of that pasuk. Now, it's true that the simple explanation of pasuk in place A may be at odds with the simple explanation in pasuk B, and each side would then need to work the other pasuk out, as indeed they do. That's not Rashi's job. Rashi's job is to explain Pshuto Shel Mikra, and you work it out. That's the first approach. But it's interesting to note that this question, and again, to be clear on the question, how are we saying it reflects badly on the Jewish people? They never brought another Korban Pesach. They're not meant to bring another Korban Pesach until they get to Eretz Yisrael. That question is actually raised by the Tosfos in Yevamos and Daf Ayin Beis. And the answer of Tosfos is it's a difficult answer, as if to say difficult to hear, but it's very clear. And that is, says Tosfos, it's true. There is no need to bring another Korban Pesach until you get to Eretz Yisrael, but it's still a gnus that they didn't bring another one for 39 years, because the gnus is, why are they not in Eretz Yisrael until 40 years later? That's the gnus. As if to say, it's true, as long as you're in the Midbar, you're exempt. So what reflects negativity? Why are you still in the Midbar? That's the gnus. They should have been there. They should have been in Eretz Yisrael this time next year. And that's, in a sense, that's the subtext of the Gnus. Another year, no one's saying you're obligated. But what are you doing here? That's how the Tosfos explained. And moreover, says the Mizrahi, it could be that Rashi also subscribes to that answer, in which case Rashi's two comments are now cohesive with each other. The earlier one, which says it applies only in Eretz Yisrael, but it's still a gnus. The gnus is not to be in Eretz Yisrael when that's where you should be already by now. So these are the Mizrahi's comments with regards to the gnus. But the final question that we need to discuss is, if indeed it's true that in principle the Korban Pesach only applies in Eretz Yisrael, then we may ask, why was there a Korban Pesach in this first year when they're in the Midbar? The halachic answer, of course, is Hora'as Shah. It was a special ruling for its time that may well be. But the question is to ask that. What's behind the Hora'as Shah, as if for Eretz Yisrael? So then don't bring the Korban Pesach this year. There's lots of things they didn't do until they got to Eretz Yisrael. No one told them to separate Trumas and Maisrus in the Midbar, or however they would do that, or Shmita, or whatever it is. They don't have. If it doesn't apply, it doesn't apply. So in a sense, the question is, if it's true, there is no obligation in principle, so what is behind this one-off obligation here? And this question is discussed by the Meshech Chochmah. And Meshech Chochmah says, and once he starts, he sweeps through. Says Meshech Chochmah, we need to know something about the Korban Pesach. Important beyond what we normally associate with it. The Korban Pesach, it celebrates our freedom from Mitzrayim. It's a Korban in the family of Korbanos. It's all of those things. But it's also something else. Korban Pesach represents a break from Avodah Zarah. As surely as the original Korban Pesach was a statement of repudiation of Avodah Zarah, of rejection of Avodah Zarah. As Chazal famously stated in the Michilta, when Moshe says to the Jewish people, Mishku ukechu lachem. Mishku literally means draw up and take for yourselves. But the Michilta says, Mishku means withdraw from Avodah Zarah. As we know, the Jewish people were involved to some degree in Avodah Zarah, and the Korban Pesach is about moving away from that. It's a statement rejecting that. And that remains true. That remains true. And therefore, there's something about the Korban Pesach which makes it a response to leaving Avodah Zarah. And we find something very interesting in the Navi, in Sefer Melachim Beis, in Perek Taf Gimel, which talks about Melech Yoshiyahu. And as we know, there's a whole thing there. It's a lot of not so righteous kings came before him, and then Yoshiyahu, and it's a throwback to as the Jewish people should be. And he kind of sweeps through the land, it's full of Avodah Zarah, and he gets rid of all of it, and that's described by about a dozen psukim. And then, in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, it says, Vayitzav HaMelech es kol ha'am lemor, Asu Pesach l'Hashem Elokeichem. He says, Pesach time, now it's time for Pesach. So it's a very interesting kind of juxtaposition. I mean, they just finished around Pesach time. I mean, that was the Pesach cleaning for that year. They kind of cleaned up the country from Avodah Zarah. But the Pasuk, the way that it describes it, says Meshech Chochmah, means it was the next step. They just done Mishru Yedeichem Avodah Zarah. They'd withdrawn people from Avodah Zarah. And the Korban, which represents the antithesis to that, and the rejection of that, is the Korban Pesach. And then the Pasuk says, Kilonasa Pesach Hazeh. There had never been a Pesach like that. Mimea Shoftim. Asher Shoftu Es Yisrael. From the times of the Shoftim. So the question says, Meshech Chochmah, what's a Pesach like that? I mean, aren't all Pesachs the same? But no, says Meshech Chochmah, what it means is with this aspect to it, where it was so much a part of that Korban that it was getting people away from Avodah Zarah, they brought Korban Pesach many, many times in the interim, but it never really had that element to it as well, so pronounced from the days of the Shoftim. That's called Kapesach Hazeh. That's in the times of Yoshiyahu. And therefore, if we come back to our situation, to Parshas Valoscha, says Meshech Chochmah, it's an amazing chiddush. In principle, in terms of the regular, quote unquote, way that korbanos work, there is no requirement or obligation or place for a korban Pesach unless you're in Eretz Yisrael. It's connected to Eretz Yisrael, according to that approach. But this year they needed it, because this is part of their rehabilitation from the... This is the first Pesach that follows the Chet HaEgel. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, it was almost like it was an honorary Korban Pesach, as if to say, although geographically they weren't where they'd normally have to be obligated, but they qualified on other grounds, because they have to now, again, in their own way, reject the Chet HaEgel. And that statement took the form of the Korban Pesach. And what's more, says Meshech Chochma, there was a second time this happened. I mean, the next time they bring the Korban Pesach, they're in Eretz Yisrael already. Right, in the days of Yeshua. But you have to know, says Meshech Chochma, and Chazal say this explicitly, the words Ki Tavo'u El Ha'aretz do not just mean entering the land and now you're here. It means when you enter the land and each one is where they should be, all right, after the conquering and after the settling and apportioning, which took 14 years. That's really when those mitzvahs apply. So, which means Truma and Maaser and all of that, it didn't apply as soon as they came in. It took another 14 years. If that's true, then the same should be true for Korban Pesach. There should not be an obligation of Korban Pesach until 14 years into their stay in Eretz Yisrael. But yet, as we know, they brought the Korban Pesach immediately when they came in. That's Yeshua, Perek Hey. Staf Torah for Pesach. Why? Says Meshech Chochma, the same reason. They're not obligated yet in Eretz Yisrael terms, but their second full in the area of Avodah Zarah took place in the final year in the Midbar, Baal Peor. And therefore, once again, formally, so to speak, there is not yet the wherewithal to mandate or require a Korban Pesach. But essentially, in terms of the anti-Avodah Zarah statement, they needed the Korban Pesach at the time. And again, obviously, as per HaKadosh Baruch Hu's instructions. Moreover, says Meshech Chochma, this may explain to us something else. The Pasuk Yud Dalet reads, V'chiyagur etchem ger. If a ger, a proselyte convert, shall live among you, V'asa Pesach Lashem. So he'll bring Pesach also. Kechukas haPesach uchuk mishpato ken yaaseh. He brings the Korban Pesach exactly like everyone else. Chuka achas yelachem velager ulezrach haaretz. And really, what that means is that a ger becomes naturalized among the Jewish people, even in this very key aspect. As soon as he's attached himself to the Jewish people, he is the heir of their history, which of course he is. If we hadn't left Mitzrayim, there would be nothing for gerim to attach themselves to, which is an amazing situation. Because again, he celebrates Yetzias Mitzrayim, even though he's not biologically descended from people that left there, but he has what to celebrate because he has what to come to, the Jewish people who left there. And that famously, as we mentioned around the Pesach time, that's part of the Chiddush of the story of Maaser Rabbi Akiva. Everybody knows this, right? Rabbi Akiva, they're all telling the story. Rabbi Akiva was not descended from people who left Mitzrayim, because Rabbi Akiva is descended from Gerim. But here he is hosting a Seder, because everyone celebrates. And that's really what the Pasuk is saying. As soon as they become part of the Jewish people, they bring the Korban Pesach, just like everyone else. But what's amazing is, and Rashi voices this, it's from Chazal, the Gemara and the Sifrei, the Pasuk isn't only being mechadish what they should do, in other words, bring the Korban Pesach with everyone else, but also what they shouldn't do. As if to say, Yochol, says Rashi, quoting Chazal, Yochol, I may have thought, kol hamisgayer yase pesach miyad. I might have thought that if he converts, so he should bring Korban Pesach straight away. Talmud Lomar. So to that end, the pasuk says, no, not straight away. Wait till Pesach, like everyone else. Talmud Lomar, chukah achas, everyone's the same. So interesting about this pasuk is that what I might have thought without the Pasuk isn't that, you know, maybe he shouldn't bring the Korban Pesach, but maybe he should bring it immediately. But of course the question is, why on earth would you bring it immediately? It's not Pesach. Why would you bring a Korban Pesach if it's not Pesach? The answer, says Meshech Chochma, is when we understand what the Korban Pesach represents. Namely, it was the Jewish people when they had formally rejected Avodah Zarah and everything other than the path of Torah, So actually, that's what happens when a person converts. I mean, they go through on an individual level that break and that statement. They place themselves together with Torah and part ways with whatever came before. In a sense, that's their Pesach experience personally. To the extent that I may have thought, had the Pasuk not told me that they should bring a Korban Pesach there and then, at whatever point in the year they join the Korban, they join the Jewish people, that's the Pesach, that's the Yetzias Mitzrayim, they should bring a Korban Pesach. So we need the Pasuk to put the brakes on that, as if to say, not so much. It's a valid thought, but practically, you're part of the Jewish people, wait till Pesach, you bring it together with the Jewish people. And the final comment, and again, it's this is the Meshech Chochma, with the idea it can impact on so many different areas, to the Navi and the Halacha and even our Psukim. You see, what's very interesting is, if we take a close look, I just have to leave the rest of the parsha, I guess, for a different time, but in, once again, Perek Tes Pasuk Beis, the mitzvah is V'yasu b'nei Yisrael es ha-pasach b'mado. B'nei Yisrael shall bring Korban Pesach in its time. Good? And then the Pasuk elaborates. Pasuk Gimel. Bar ba'asa yom, b'chodesh hazeh b'in ha-bayim, on the 14th, in the afternoon, ta'asu oso b'mado, you shall perform it in its time. Kuchofu gosa v'chom ishbatav ta'asu oso. In accordance with all of its statutes, etc. and so forth. And perhaps one may add that the reason why the Torah needed to emphasize that this Korban Pesach shall be brought with Kol Chol Chukosav Uchachol Mishpatav, it's perhaps one may have thought that since, in a sense, it's not a pure obligation of Korban Pesach, because that only applies in Eretz Yisrael, but rather it's as a response to the Egel, perhaps it doesn't have the entire shape of a Korban Pesach with all of the halachas that go with it. Talmud Lomar, it does. In other words, if it's Pesach, it's Pesach. If you're obligated in Korban Pesach, it's with the whole thing. Matzos, the Marorim, and all of that. Matzah's got nothing to do with Avodah Zarah, neither does Maror. But if it's Pesach, it's Pesach. But what's very interesting, we see now from the general discussion to the nuance, to the details. If we have a look in Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Gimel, there's been a grammatical shift. Because Pasuk Beis is written in the third person, V'yasu b'nei Yisrael es ha-pesach b'mo'ado. Pasuk Gimel shifts to the second person. V'asa yom, v'chodesh z'abin avayim, ta'asu oso. That's second person, that's you. So Pasuk Beis says, they shall do it, and Pasuk Gimel says, you shall do it. But the question is, who are they, and who are you? I mean, you are them, you're all Jewish. What is behind this shift? That's a good, and again, these are psukim one could read many, many times, as we do, and not catch that shift. Says Meshech Chochma, there is a difference. And in fact, one could almost say that this it now follows on the other side of what's been in between, namely the separation of Shevet Levi. What is the flow of the sequence of topics in Parshas Balosra? Begins with a menorah, as we discussed, then it moves on to the separation of Levi, and then we move into Korban Pesach. But let's go back just to reflect on the separation of Levi, as the Pasuk itself says. Why are Levi separated? Levi are separated because they stood firm while everyone else had a fall, with reference to the Chet HaEgel. And because they were faithful, they now become separated to the extent that they do. Says Meshech Chochma, but let's just consider for a moment. If it is the case that there is no natural, shall we say, Korban Pesach outside of Eretz Yisrael, except it is an instruction for that year from HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a reaction and as part of the recovery from the Chet HaEgel, is there perhaps room to think that Shevet Levi will not have a part in this Korban? As surely as they had no part in the chet that was generated the obligation for this korban. That's an interesting thought. In fact, it's so interesting, says Meshech Chochma, that that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed to emphasize that they will bring the Korban Pesach. And that is the difference in connotation between talking about Bnei Yisrael in the third person. Hashem, I mean, who is Hashem talking to? He's talking to Moshe. And then saying, you shall bring. What is being emphasized here? You means first and foremost, you Moshe. And the point is, no one was more removed from the Chet HaEgel than Moshe. I mean, he was literally in a different plane. He was on Har Sinai. So the question is, do you also have to bring the Korban Pesach? Yes. You and everyone like you. All of Shevet Levi. And why? One may ask. In other words, the question is a good question. Why is the answer better? The question is arguing that if this Korban Pesach is a recovery from the Egel, then those who didn't fall in the Egel, they have no need for recovery, so why are they part of the Korban Pesach? The answer, says Meshe Chachma, is because Shevet Levi, is as much as in personally or tribally, they were not involved in the Egel, but they're part of the Jewish people. In other words, it can't reach a situation as much as they've been removed. And in a sense, this is the balance that has to be struck. They're treated differently. They become the Kohanim, they become the Levim, etc. Yes, but if the Jewish people are bringing a Korban, you can't not be part of that because you're part of the Jewish people. And everyone was really part of the aftermath of the Egel. Nothing was the same for anyone. And what's amazing is, says Meshe Chachma, not only, and therefore, just to be clear, as to, therefore, Pasuk Beis, the Asu Bnei Yisrael, they in the third person, but also you, Pasuk Gimel, Tasu Oso, everyone is involved. And what's amazing is the follow-up, because as we mentioned, this begins with Pesach Rishon, but it becomes Pesach Sheni. How does it become Pesach Sheni? Because there were some people who were, they could bring the Korban Pesach at the time. They were Temeim the Nefesh Adam. And therefore they said, Lama Nigara, right? They say in modern Hebrew, Zelo Fair. Then everyone's bringing the Korban Pesach, and we're going to bring the Korban Pesach. And the response was, amazingly, Pesach Sheni, you get another chance. Who were these people? Well, the Gemara discusses this famously in Sukkah, in Daf Kahei, in the Sifrei. And there's a very interesting opinion in Chazal that these people, how are they Tomei? They were Tomei because they were the ones that took out Nadav and Avihu, who died on the first day of the Mishkan, which is very shortly before all of this is happening. And they didn't have time to become Tohar yet. Who took out Nadav and Avihu? The Pasuk tells us. Two individuals, Mishael and Eltzafan, Bnei Uziel. Who is Uziel? Uziel is the son of Kahas, brother number four, grandson of Levi. Mishael and Eltzafan were Levim. And that's very interesting, because it's certainly in light of our discussion, says Meshe Chachma, that they shouldn't even have, it's not even entirely clear why they're obligated to bring a Korban Pesach in the first place. I mean, they acted in a stellar fashion at the time of the Egel. But all of the Jewish people have the Egel. But they're Tomei. So one could have imagined that they would say, listen, okay, if we're Tomei, we can't do it. And what do they say? Well, why should we lose out? And what do they mean by that? Because if we look at the way they phrase their situation and their protest, one phrase sticks out. Pasuk Zion of Perek Tes. Vayomru ha'anashim ma'eme lemor. Pasuk Zion. And after training the Nefesh Adam, we're Tomei. Lomani Gora. Why should we lose out? Levilti ha'krivis korban Hashem b'mo'ado. Not to bring Hashem's korban at the point of time. Besoch b'nei Yisrael. Amongst b'nei Yisrael. Here's Levi. Not only are they Levi, they're Levis that can't bring the korban. And they say, but we will lose out. We won't gain. We'll lose out. Because Shevet Levi is part of the Jewish people. That's why they're bringing a Korban for something they didn't even do. Because the Jewish people did it, and they're part of the Jewish people. And so are we. And if we're Tomei, we protest. Because we're not prepared to be distinct from the Jewish people, even for bringing that Korban. And the result from that was Pesach Sheni, as we say. So there's plenty to discuss here. And as we mentioned, as soon as the idea begins, and to see in the hands of the great Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen in the Meshe Chochma, the whole parsha opens up, Kedarko Shel Torah. I'll leave it over there for the evening.